Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In Bombay, we're going to have the latest from India in a few moments. But first, in a surprise move, the White House, in what it insists is not a reversal of policy, announced today that all detainees held anywhere in U.S. military custody are entitled to fair treatment as prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions. President Bush originally said members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban did not qualify for Geneva protection. This move came as the first of three congressional hearings on detainees' rights kicked off this morning. Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont and the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, supports giving detainees more rights than the military commission set up by the Bush administration and struck down, called illegal by the Supreme Court. Leahy accused the Bush administration of setting up kangaroo court procedures. But Daniel Del Orto, legal counsel for the Department of Defense, says Congress should legalize the current military commissions and not give detainees the rights given to soldiers in courts martial.
It would be ludicrous, in my estimation, to accord those sorts of rights at that level, to that degree, to the sorts of people we have here who would get far less in the way of protections where they tried in their home countries, wherever those countries might be.
But now, as we said, the Bush administration has announced that detainees do deserve at least the same protection under the Geneva Convention as prisoners of war. Well, joining us on the line from outside the Judiciary Committee hearing room is Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and intelligence correspondent for the Financial Times. And Dimitri, first of all, welcome back. You were with us yesterday. And today, you broke this story, which has now been confirmed, that the Bush administration is extending these Geneva Convention rights to all detainees. In your opinion, is that a reversal? It sure feels like it.
It's absolutely a reversal. Let me read you a quick line from a memo that President Bush signed in February 7, 2002. Commoner Article 3 of Geneva does not apply either to Al-Qaeda or Taliban detainees. So clearly, this is a 180-degree reversal. It was prompted partly by the Supreme Court decision on Hamdan a couple of weeks ago, and probably was also informed by a campaign by military lawyers that's been growing over the last few years, arguing that If U.S. military employees, soldiers, want to have protections overseas, the U.S. needs to give protections to the detainees that it's holding.
And we're going to be speaking to one of those lawyers in a moment. But might it also be prompted by the fact that there are hearings being held today for the nomination of a new federal judge? And this is someone, William Haynes, the Pentagon General Counsel, who was instrumental in writing some of the interrogation policies and is now being considered as a judge. And some might say, well, perhaps this is a way of, you know, throwing a bone out in that direction as well.
Well, I think from Mr. Haynes' perspective, it's probably a useful thing to have happened. It'll soften some of the opposition from some senators. However, other senators, like the Republican Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, has blocked his nomination, not because of his role in promulgating the military commissions, but more his role in writing the so-called torture memos, which the administration was later forced to rescind. But I think, you know, it's unlikely that the White House would sign off on a measure just to help Mr. Haynes get a judgeship. But certainly the timing of the congressional hearings on the Hamdan decision itself and how the administration needs to proceed to try the detainees at Guantanamo had a huge bearing on the timing of this.
Well, and what exactly does it mean, this extending Article 3 protection or protection of the Geneva Conventions to detainees? Does it mean that the evidence from harsh interrogations, some call it torture, will not be allowed in trials of detainees? Or does it mean that the torture will not be allowed? What does it mean?
It means both. Torture should not be allowed, and evidence gained from torture, if it does happen, will not be permissive in a court. I mean, of course, the Detainee Treatment Act, which John McCain sponsored late last year, already prohibits the use of torture and the use of evidence garnered through torture. But today on Capitol Hill, one of the administration lawyers has argued that while evidence from torture would not be allowed, evidence gained through coercion, depending on what level of coercion it was, might possibly be allowed under the commissions as they're currently structured. So I think there's going to be some debate as to, you know, what is torture, what are coercive methods. The administration is arguing that some of the definitions of inhumane treatment under Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions are vague. And so Congress is still going to have a role over the next few months in determining what can the administration do and what they cannot do.
Does this change in policy apply to just terror suspects in U.S. military custody and perhaps not those that we understand now are held in secret prisons, by the CIA or by foreign governments?
The Pentagon memo itself applies only to detainees held in U.S. military custody, so it would not apply, for example, to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, who's being held somewhere in the world, we don't know where, by the CIA. However, one of the Justice Department lawyers who was testifying in front of the Judiciary Committee this morning suggested that the administration's shift of policy, although they didn't call it that, on Common Article 3 was because the Supreme Court says this applies to all detainees in the war on terror. Now, I think that opens up the door for the possibility that the CIA may also have to comply with this, but I think there's going to be a lot of legal wrangling over the next few weeks over that issue.
Dimitri Sevastopoulou, Pentagon and Intelligence Correspondent for the Financial Times. Thank you so much for visiting us 2 days in a row. We really
appreciate
it.
Thank you very much. A pleasure.
Thank you.
Bye.
Well, now, for some analysis, we turn to two top legal experts with perhaps differing opinions. John Hudson, Dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center in Concord, New Hampshire, and until his retirement in 2000, Rear Admiral John Hudson was the Navy's top judge advocate general, or JAG. He'll testify about detainee legal rights before Congress tomorrow and Thursday, and he's also joined other JAGs in filing briefs criticizing the Bush administration's legal strategies. Dean Hudson, welcome.
Thank you, Robin. It's good to be here.
And also joining us on the line from Washington, Attorney David Rifkin, who served in the Justice Department under Presidents Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Mr. Rifkin, welcome to you as well.
Good to be with you.
And I'd like to start with you. Since the Supreme Court decision striking down the Bush administration's Guantanamo Bay procedures, you've written and spoken in defense of the Bush administration's legal strategies. You called the ruling a setback with a silver lining. I'd like to know what that silver lining is. But before that, your response to the administration's statement today that it's going to extend Article 3 protections to the detainees, it almost seems to agree, at least in part, with the Supreme Court.
Well, let me say first that I think the administration's statement, in some sense, is unavoidable given the DOD memo on the subject.
The Department of Defense memo?
Yes, which takes this position. I think it is a very unfortunate memo. It is a premature memo, and it is certainly not based upon the sound interpretation of what the court said. My problem is very simple. It is not, repeat, not the substantive contours of Common Article 3, because those parameters for treatment of detainees, namely humane treatment, no inhumane and degrading punishment or torture, appropriate level of due process when being punished, are already in place as a matter of administration policy. And I have absolutely no problem of Congress in enacting a new statute to deal with military commissions, perhaps with other aspects of detainee treatment, or to use the strongest possible words to compel this result.
Well, we've heard from analysts, though, that if the Congress does decide to pass laws that, in fact, make what the Bush administration does legal, the Supreme Court could just strike it down again.
No. The Supreme Court, even the five justices in the majority, pretty clearly indicated, well, four out of five, actually, Justice Stevens did not say that, that Congress can pretty much do what it feels needs to be done here. But let me just make one very important point. I have no problem with the substantive content of Article 3 being replicated in congressional statute. What I have enormous problem with, and it's a problem of symbolism, but just like with many issues of public policy, be it Social Security or Medicare or laws of war, symbolism is important, is plucking a provision from a regime, namely Geneva Conventions of 1949, but apply to lawful combatants, plucking it out of that regime and applying it as a matter of law to unlawful combatants, because that approach tends to erode the distinction, which is vitally important to preserve, between lawful and unlawful combatants.
You've said it would effectively legitimize the illegal and barbaric type of asymmetric warfare these unlawful combatants practice.
That is correct, which is, and by the way, this distinction and the need to stigmatize, delegitimize unlawful combatants is not new. It wasn't invented by the Bush administration. It's hundreds of years old, but certainly the problem is far more acute than ever before. And we absolutely, look, there's a fundamental difference between lawful combatants who, even on an individual basis, let's assume that the story about Hadith or the story about rape is correct. You start as a lawful combatant, you start as an honorable soldier. On an individual basis, you violate the laws of war, you get prosecuted for it and punished, however, harshly.
Well, David Rifkin, I'm going to, okay, finish your thought.
The difference between that and unlawful combatants who are en masse, can do nothing right, do everything. everything illegitimate, and that distinction needs to be maintained.
That's David Rifkin, who served in the Justice Department under previous presidents. But Dean Hudson, I know you want to jump in here. You've said that, and you are a former JAG lawyer, you've said that this kind of treatment of detainees could only harm U.S. soldiers who were perhaps taken during combat. Your reaction to what Mr. Rifkin said and what the Bush White House has said today?
Well, my reaction certainly to what the Bush White House has said today is very positive. I think that it may be late, but it's certainly a positive response to the court's decision for Secretary England and the Department of Defense to say that Common Article 3 applies across the board to everybody.
But by the way, for those who've just turned in, we want to say that in somewhat a surprise move, the White House said today that all detainees held anywhere in U.S. military custody are entitled to fair treatment as prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions. David Rifkin is upset with that announcement from the White House. Dean Hudson, you're happy with it. Why else do you think that's important?
Well, I agree entirely with my friend and colleague, Mr. Rifkin, with regard to symbolism. I think that this is a great symbolic move, substantive as well, but there is a big chunk of symbolism in what Secretary England has done by saying that Common Article 3 applies across the board, that the United States is going to comply with it, we're going to take the high ground, we will be able to argue forevermore that Common Article 3 applies to everybody, to our troops, to other troops, and there's nothing, as David says, there's really nothing in there that we should be afraid of. We should be shouting it from the rooftops. Common Article 3, talks about humiliating and degrading treatment and violence of life and person, including murder and mutilation.
Well, it's not only about that. It's about fair trials and process.
And that's right. And the part of Common Article 3 that the court was referring to says that, and I quote, that sentences should be pronounced by a regularly constituted court affording all the judicial guarantees which are recognized as indispensable by civilized peoples. There is nothing in that quote that the United States should be afraid of or try to avoid. Indeed, we should celebrate it and encourage every country on the face of the earth to follow it.
That's John Hudson. David Rifkin, quick question to you. Do you think the White House announcement today is going to take the steam out of the move to keep the military commissions the way they are, to not make adjustments after the Supreme Court ruling?
No, I do not think that the identicality of treatment as far as procedures are concerned between courts martial and military commissions would be established in this new statute as a result. I think even the more reasonable critics understand that there can be some deviations from the procedures for courts martial, particularly on the issue of a so-called right confrontation and admissibility of some type of evidence. But again, quite frankly, to me at least, it is not about the practical details. What I don't understand, critics, including my good friend Dean Hudson, not appreciating the wrong symbolism of treating the scourge of humanity, the worst of the worst.
Dave Rifkin, I'm going to have to hold you up there, and this conversation will continue. The first of three congressional hearings on this issue kicks off today. Dave Rifkin and John Hudson, both of you, thanks so much for joining us. And we'll have you back again. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Tourist traffic, but today, with thousands of tourists from around the country on the roads, the most expensive highway project in U.S. history is the source of miles of backups because of a deadly accident inside a newly built tunnel. A woman traveling in a car inside the tunnel was crushed to death by a 3-ton slab of concrete that fell from the ceiling late last night. The driver survived. The $14.6 billion Big Dig project has been plagued by cost overruns and problems, including water leaks inside other tunnels. But officials have always maintained the extensive system of roads and tunnels is safe. Today, the chair of the Massachusetts Turnpike Authority, Matt Amarello, was forced to address that safety question again. WBUR's Morning Edition host Bob Oakes asked him if he thought the tunnel was safe. After a lengthy answer about the tragedy, Bob asked again.
With all due respect, Mr. Chairman, you did not say in that answer that you think these tunnels are safe. Do you think they're safe?
Yes, I do think they're safe. What occurred was an awful, awful, tragic accident. It should not have occurred. We're investigating that. I have confidence in these tunnel systems, in the roads that were built here.
Reporter Sean Murphy is a member of the Boston Globe Spotlight team. They've investigated the Big Dig project, and he's on the scene today. Sean, you're right outside the scene of the accident with other reporters. What do you see there?
Well, the scene here is somewhat chaotic as a whole horde of reporters are trying to get answers out of the Turnpike Authority for why this happened and whether the public can, frankly, feel safe traveling in these tunnels.
You just came from a news conference. Tell us more about what happened. How big a chunk fell and why did it fall?
Well, Robin, I'm being very circumspect because there is the potential here for a criminal investigation. In fact, on the advice of the U.S. attorney and the district attorney, the scene is being secured for a possible criminal investigation. However, the basic idea here is that there's a false ceiling of concrete and it hangs down from the true ceiling and is hung by bolts, steel bolts. One of those bolts apparently gave way and in doing so created kind of a domino effect leading to other bolts pulling out and thus the collapse of this very heavy concrete vault ceiling.
Sean, when you say a possibility of a criminal investigation, along what lines? What do you mean?
It could be, you know, negligence of such a gross magnitude that it would be a criminal investigation, a manslaughter. Or there could be some evidence of shortcuts taken, which would be, in a sense, defrauding the public of a safe tunnel.
Well, let's remind listeners, this is a marvel of engineering, but it has had problems in the past that have led to charges. Would you remind us of those?
Recently, the U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Michael Sullivan, brought indictments against half a dozen individuals for a company, Aggregate Concrete, charging them with knowingly providing inferior concrete for the construction of some sections of the Big Dig. And those defendants are presumably going to go to trial.
Yeah, and there were also problems of water leaks in parts of the tunnel system. At least one incident where some dirt came from an air shaft in another section of the tunnel system. What are officials saying?
They're trying to, I think, itemize, separate the various problems and deal with them individually as if not related. And that seems to be the case. There has been a lot of water leaks here and penetration of the tunnel walls as well by water. And it's a troubling situation, Robin.
And what are people saying about fear? You know, this incident is horrific to imagine. And is there concern that people aren't going to want to take the tunnel?
Well, I think that's a reality that we each individually face. It's very present. People do not want to drive in an area where they don't have confidence the ceiling's not going to fall and crash on them and kill them. It's a very difficult reality. I don't know that I've heard of any recently completed construction project of this nature where there's been this failure, this deadly failure.
What has Mayor Menino, Boston's Mayor Menino, said about the tragedy and how he wants an investigation to proceed?
Well, he wants an independent investigation, not one conducted by the Turnpike Authority, which does seem to have some wisdom to it. Probably for too long, the Turnpike Authority and the project officials have been left on their own to, in effect, investigate themselves. And Menino is calling for a more independent investigation.
What is the status of the Big Dig? Tons of federal money has already poured into it. We know other highway projects across the country put on hold because of it. But is it finished?
It is said to be substantially complete. And all the major all the roadways and ramps are open, but there are frequent temporary closures in the middle of the night for remedial work to be done. And, of course, there's the greenway that has to be cleaned up on the surface.
This is the surface of, because everything was put underground. All these roads in Boston were put underground. That was a major part of the work, and now there's a greenway above it. So, but it's not dependent on that much more federal money, I guess, is the question?
No. In fact, the federal government said it won't pay any more. Senator John McCain, led that battle three or four years ago, and it's capped as far as the federal contribution is concerned, and instead any increases to be borne by state taxpayers alone.
Is there any sense of how much longer this area, this stretch of the Big Dig, might be closed because, as you said, it might be part of a criminal investigation?
It's no indication, really. They're saying at noon tomorrow there might be some openings, but it's too early to say.
Yeah. Have you seen...
Well, I'm about to go into the tunnel myself now.
As you go into the tunnel, one last question. You've seen the accident site from a distance. What is it? I mean, how big is this slab? What were your thoughts when you saw it?
The slab itself is 40 feet by 20, and it's some 6 to 10 such slabs have fallen. It is a horrific sight of a great deal of very heavy debris, and one doesn't really want to imagine such a thing falling on one's car.
Sean Murphy of the Boston Globe Spotlight Team reporting on the collapse of ceiling panels in a tunnel under Boston, part of Boston's Big Dig project. A woman was killed last night when that portion came down. The tunnel has been closed, causing traffic backups across the city. Sean, thanks so much for your time.
Robin, thank you.
And when we come back, we'll go to India to hear about today's deadly bombings in Bombay. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
Explosions went off across the city's expansive commuter rail network. Mumbai, formerly Bombay, is India's financial capital. Mumbai's police chief said well over 100 people have been killed, several hundred injured. The blasts occurred after a series of grenade attacks by Islamic extremists killed 8 people in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Reporter Veer Singh joins us live now from New Delhi. And Veer, 7 explosions in Mumbai's commuter rail system. Do we know more about them?
Well, what we do know from the authorities in Mumbai is that they all occurred pretty much on the same leg of the commuter train network, the Western Line. There were 7 blasts. And it seems from news reports that they targeted in some of the blasts the higher paying passengers, as in the more well-heeled commuters were targeted,
We understand these were all in the first class cabins.
Exactly. Right. So it all adds to this overall impression by the authorities that this was a well-planned, well-thought-out, and above all, a well-coordinated attack. To be able to strike in a city that has already seen a series of bombings more than a decade ago, being India's financial capital, all of that, you would think that many systems were in place. So, and we've heard in past months and years of at least one or two, foiled attempts that were foiled by authorities. So this is one that they couldn't see coming or couldn't stop from happening. It happened during the rush hour.
We understand that India's home minister told reporters that authorities have known for some time that an attack was coming. They had some information, but they couldn't know where or when. Do they know who? Has there been any claim of responsibility?
Well, it's really not very helpful to speculate, because this usually contributes towards tensions between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. India cannot, without further examination of the evidence, really make a responsible statement. I can say, however, that past occasions, such as the attack on the Indian Parliament in 2001 and certain subsequent attacks at religious places, particularly, places of very significance to the Hindu religion, were attacked. And on these occasions, the government of India did indicate that a group that was supposed to have been dismantled, in fact, banned, and that used to be based in Pakistan, was responsible. They've named on past occasions the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which officially does not exist, and that's the question on the minds of every reporter in India, asking, the Indian leaders, was this group involved or, another group that is standing in for it?
Well, but then your answer also is no one has claimed responsibility. But in the meantime, just give us a sense of scene. We understand that they've asked all Indians in Bombay, everyone, to stay away from stations. There's 16 million people in that city. It must have a huge impact.
Well, they clearly cannot stay away from stations for very long. Initially, news reports have told us that people are preferring to walk even on sections where there are trains running. Of course, that's understandable in the wake of, awful pictures and accounts and, cell phone conversations informing each other of the horrific events of rush hour. So you have you know, tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people just stranded all over the city. We've seen TV pictures of people just, you know, without any access to buses. Mm. A few of them could access taxis, you know, mini rickshaws and all of that. But the majority of them seem to be walking, you know, as far as they can. A few of them have used their cell phones to call friends and relatives in whatever part of the city that they're stranded in the hope that they'll have a place to sleep the night. That's mm-hmm. what Bombay looks like. Now, you know, they may have told people to stay at home, but they cannot. This commuter train network carries millions of people from the, you know, far-lying, outlying suburbs into Bombay, so there's no question of people being able to stay away. If they did stay away, then India's financial capital would indeed come to a halt.
And it would ricochet across the region. Veer Singh speaking from New Delhi about today's series of bombings in Bombay, Mumbai, killing well over 130 people, according to officials. Veer, thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And we just want to spend a few more minutes on, you know, talk of the tensions in the region with Professor Adil Najam at the Fletcher School of Diplomacy and Law outside of Boston. And, Professor, you heard Veer mentioned a group with connections to Pakistan, possibly supposedly disbanded. Speculation, as he said, is dangerous, but it is happening. What is yours?
There is speculation happening, and it is dangerous. The Lashkar-e-Taiba has been involved reportedly and allegedly in a number of activities in India. It is technically banned, but some of its members may still be active. I think the important point here is also to look at the other blast that happened today. So there was also a second set of synchronized attacks in Srinagar in Kashmir. Mm-hmm. They were less sophisticated than what happened in Mumbai. And one of the big questions is whether the two are connected.
And what would that say to you?
That would escalate tensions in India to a much higher level. India has had a long history of these blasts, but they have been on two parallel, related but distinct streams. One of them was related to the Kashmir issue, and that would usually happen in the north of the country, in New Delhi, in Kashmir, and that's where the Lashkar-e-Taiba has been allegedly involved. Mm-hmm. A second set of blasts has been happening in Mumbai, the biggest of those in 1993, and then again in 2002, again in 2003. And these have been largely because of sectarian tensions between the extreme elements of Hindu politics and the extreme elements of Muslim politics, and they have been of a distinct nature. Now, if we were to find out that the two are now merging, that would just raise the level of sophistication of the attacks, the level of tensions, the level of concerns in the populace.
So if there was a convergence between the Indian-controlled group in the group in Indian-controlled Kashmir and the sectarian groups in Bombay, that obviously would be of great concern. Just in the minute and a half that we have, what happens in a city like Bombay when something like this happens? I mean, here in Boston, we've been, you know, hand-wringing about a huge traffic backup and certainly a tragedy with a woman killed. But we're trying to imagine, you know, bomb blasts across a railway in a city like Bombay. What is happening there in your mind?
This is a very resilient city. This is a very large city, one of the largest in the world. But it is also a city that has a history of such incidents and has learned from it. And that's come out in two ways. One is the type of measured statements you are seeing from the Indian government, including the Prime Minister, which is actually trying to stay away from speculation because they know that you can have even more massive violence in the aftermath of these things than in the tragedy itself. But what we are also seeing is, it seems, at least in these early hours, a very resilient civil society response.
Right, people helping each other out.
Helping each other out even before the police comes in. Mm-hmm. What we are hearing is, you know, people throwing bed sheets and stopping taxis to take people to hospitals and stuff. So it has been a robust response.
Professor Adil Najam, the Fletcher School of Diplomacy and Law. Thank you so much, Professor.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Well, switching gears from today's news, It took a year and 14 trades, but Kyle MacDonald, a young Canadian and aspiring writer, got himself a house. All he had for purchasing power was the notion to barter and a red paper clip. Fortunately, he also had Craigslist, the internet marketplace with localized portals. He traded the clip for a fish pen, which he then traded for a ceramic knob and so on. He became an online sensation and finally was offered a movie role to trade. That caught the attention of the town of Kipling in Saskatchewan province in Canada. The town took MacDonald up on the offer of the movie role and swapped for the house. In September, he and his girlfriend will move into their three-bedroom, 1,100-square-foot home provided by the town. And Kyle MacDonald joins us on the line. Congratulations.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're calling this a community project because the community does get a lot out of it, don't they?
The community of Kipling is going to benefit quite a bit from this, and I think the whole project was somewhat community-driven because if I hadn't met 14 people along the way, none of this would have ever happened.
Well, one of those people happened to be actor Corbin Burnson?
Yeah, Corbin Burnson found out about the project, wanted to get involved, and he actually offered up a role in a paid speaking role in his movie, Donna on Demand.
Well, now let's talk about this, because this is where this gets very interesting. I mean, I think people can understand, oh, you kept trading up and trading up and trading up. But you were offered at one point a year's worth of free rent in Phoenix. Now, Corbin Burnson contacted you because he heard about your story. He knew that this would be good publicity for him, you know, to give away a role in his movie. You didn't trade him for that year's rent in Phoenix. Why not?
Corbin sort of said very bluntly, and I agree with him, if you can find something I can use, I'll trade you the role for it. And he doesn't need a year of rent in Phoenix. He doesn't live there. And I actually had an afternoon with Alice Cooper after that. He's actually met Alice Cooper, so he couldn't use that either.
Wait a minute. Somebody traded you an afternoon with Alice Cooper for what? For the year's rent?
Yeah. I had a year of rent in the half a duplex in Phoenix. In the other half of the duplex is a woman named Leslie. She actually works for Alice Cooper. She offered an afternoon with her boss for 1 year of free rent.
Terrific. And so now you've had the afternoon with Alice Cooper. Then you traded what for something that Corbin Burnson wanted?
I traded the afternoon with Alice Cooper for a snow globe. And this is the kind of thing that people thought I was crazy, but Corbin Burnson is one of the world's largest collectors of snow globes. And I had a KISS snow globe, something he'd never seen, really was into it. And it was perfect because the movie role had no value. You can't sell a role in the movie. And the snow globe, the value of a snow globe is relative on how I guess deeply you are in the world of snow globes.
So now you've traded the snow globe, and by the way, you encouraged everyone else on Craigslist following this to also send Corbin Burnson snow globes, and he gave you this role, and you now traded that movie role for the house in Kipling in Canada. What is the town of Kipling going to do with that movie role?
The town of Kipling is going to have like an American Idol style audition for the role this Labor Day weekend. And it's an open invite from anyone around the world to go to Kipling and audition for the role. Corbin's actually hinted that he might cast more than one role in the town, so it could be a bunch of speaking roles or background roles. It's a really good chance for people to get into movies, I guess.
Well, we read that the town fathers were in tears when they heard that they had sort of, you know, won this, that you took up their offer and are going to settle there, you and your girlfriend going to settle in their town. This meant a lot to them. This was a town that apparently needs a boost.
Yeah, a lot of rural communities in Canada, especially Saskatchewan, are actually in decline. People are leaving. They're going to the big cities. And Kipling's sort of actually one of the few that's growing slowly, and they really want to keep working at that. They have a really good, strong community and have a lot of ideas, and I guess the Red Paperclip Project fits right in with the values they have there.
Well, so it's a very happy ending for the town. Tell us some of the things that along the way, some of the offers that you got. I mean, it's real insight also into this online trading world. What were some of the offers that you got you didn't take up?
I was offered a full-body laser hair removal for two people, but it was only applicable to residents of Kentucky or Tennessee. That was a bizarre one. I was offered lots of cars and vehicles and lots of big objects. I really like things that you couldn't put a dollar value on. There's no way you can put a dollar value on an afternoon with Alice Cooper.
Or 10 hectares. Well, you can actually probably put a dollar value on 10 hectares of land in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yeah. It's sort of fun playing around with the relative value of things. You could arguably say the red paperclip is worth a house. It just needed to meet 14 people to swap with along the way.
Kyle MacDonald, who traded a red paperclip all the way up to the house that he's going to move into in Kipling, named after Rudyard Kipling, in Saskatchewan, Canada, and has made that town very happy. Kyle, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
Thank you.
Bruce Springsteen had his first hit album with Born in the USA. Well, there were some who were certain that this would be the last gasp of roots rock in general and guitar rock in particular. MTV was changing the ground rules, and Madonna wouldn't pick up a guitar for another few decades. Well, Here Now music critic Tim Riley swears that roots rock is alive and kicking from two new bands, one old, one new. He says there's still a lot of gas left in guitar rock's tank.
If I could be a little bit happier, if I could be a little more cranky, if I could be a little more Dixie, if I could be a little more Yankee.
And Tim Riley joins us in the studio. That sounds like it could have been made at any point in the last 40 years. Little Creedence Clearwater. What is it?
Well, that is the Bottle Rockets, and they have a brand new album called Zoysia. Creedence is the key reference here, and Creedence is the gold standard. Obviously, John Fogerty is a very special guy in terms of writing and singing. You're not going to get a second John Fogerty. But the style is still alive and still worth pursuing. And I've chosen a couple bands to play today that are pursuing this style very well on the margins. You're not going to hear them on the radio. You're not going to see them on the charts. But they're really worthwhile records to catch on to.
You've said this is what, you know, used to be called rockabilly in the 70s?
Well, it is. What it really is a marriage of country music and R&B. So you're talking about bands like the Jayhawks and the Old 97s and the Drive-By Truckers and BR-549. It'll be a regular rock and roll quartet, two guitars, bass, and drums, sometimes augmented by a steel guitar, and often with an organ. So it gives it more of a country slant, a country flavor, and also a little bit of a gospel tinge.
Let's listen a little more of the Bottle Rockets. Why don't you tell us, who are they?
Well, the Bottle Rockets, all you need to know about the Bottle Rockets is that they're from Festus, Missouri. Okay? And so the key word is Festus. All right? Well, they used to hang out with Uncle Tupelo when Jeff Tweedy and Jay Farrar were forming Uncle Tupelo. There's a very famous country rock split, and those guys go off to form Wilco and Sunvolt. Bottle Rockets actually come out of that same sort of genre. They've been around 10 years. They put out 9 CDs, and this CD was recorded at legendary Memphis studios called Ardent Studios, which are legendary because Al Green recorded there. So mm-hmm. If you're going to go and step into those rooms, you have some kind of aspirations in terms of the kind of music you cut.
In my neck of the woods, the town where I live, it's out in the sticks and conservative. Got lots of churches, we got lots of bars, and the kids round here, they fight our wars.
And the music sounds a little bit as if the people who play it maybe drive trucks.
Right, exactly. Well, this is part of what they're toying with. It's redneck music. But part of what is appealing about the Bottle Rockets is the way they express their ambivalence about redneck values through redneck music. So they depend on a certain amount of irony in their sound. And the title song really expresses that well. It's called Zoysia. Now, Zoysia is a kind of crabgrass that they get down south.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it's about is, you know, these rednecks, they're neighbors. And sometimes we mow each other's lawns. And we get along fine. But you can tell this guy can't stand redneck politics and redneck values. But he adores redneck music. All right. So how do you express that through the music? And that's what the song Zoysia is about. It's a really terrific metaphor because it's crabgrass. It's everywhere. We live in it.
Some states are red, some states are blue. We like to simplify and believe it's true.
Okay, so you hear a very simple formula there, right? Those weird open guitar chords, that loping catch-up drumming, and the wearied vocals. So you're grounded in something familiar, but there's also something fresh about it. It's an original idea set to some familiar sounds.
Okay, so that's Zoysia, the title track from the CD Zoysia from the Bottle Rockets. It's their 9th CD. So tell us about the younger bands.
Well, there's a band from Detroit that I've taken quite a liking to called the Dead String Brothers. And if the Dead String Brothers, if you could sum them up in one quick phrase, it would be, here's a band that loved the Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers so much that they said that we want to just create a whole band that sort of tries to reach that sound and that ethic that you get on Sticky Fingers. And I think they actually come pretty darn close. This is Dead String Brothers.
It ain't on you. Keeps taking
Deadstream Brothers Toe the Line. You know, again, I feel like I've heard it before, but I haven't, right? This is
right.
Original?
No, it's brand new. It's an original material. And, of course, they're taking a lot of familiar elements. You know, the guitar, there's sort of a gospel chorus there. There's some lap steel on this record. There's some organ on the record. So you get all these familiar elements, but you're getting some original material, very strong original material here. It's very hooky, too. Now, they cover a song by the band, and the song is one you'll recognize, but it's an album track. It doesn't get any radio play. It's called Get Up, Jake.
Get up, Jake. It's late in the morning. The rain is pouring. We got work to do. Get up, Jake.
It's Deadstream Brothers singing the band's Get Up, Jake. You know, we started by saying how this sort of roots music, you know, came in large part from Bruce Springsteen. And, you know, here's an irony. So how he's out playing folk.
He's out playing folk music
Pete
now.
Pete Seeger's music.
Right. Which is a little weird, I just have to say. I just think it's a little bit like Paul McCartney doing a tribute to Billy Joel. It just is not,
oh.
I'm sorry. But, you know, the thing to remember about roots rock is that it's all around us nowadays. It sounds really, it's kind of like the nose on our face of musical styles. However, when it first broke through in the mid-50s, when it was rockabilly, when it was this marriage of country and R&B, and that it's still going, nobody predicted that we would have roots rock bands 50 years later. I mean, and that just really speaks to an enormous amount of creativity, because you're talking about a very confining style. Three chords, two guitars, bass and drums, 3 minutes, go. And the fact that they still can find new melodies in that framework is really a testament to their creativity.
Well, we're going to leave you another illustration of what they do with those requirements. This is She's About a Mover from Bottle Rockets Live. It's their CD recorded at their live concert in Germany. And as always, Tim Riley, pop critic for Here and Now, who also writes Blog Riley on the archjournal.com website. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Barbara.
And stay a while after school, because I want to talk to you about Pete Seeger.
She was walking down the street, looking fine as she could be. Hey, hey, said she was walking down the street, looking fine as she could be. Hey.
Well, before we go, we have news from the music world today that Syd Barrett, one of the founders of the legendary rock band Pink Floyd, passed away last week at his home in Cambridgeshire, England, at 60. Barrett contributed most of the songs and vocals to Pink Floyd's 1967 debut album, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn. A creative genius, he introduced some of the otherworldly guitar and electronic sounds that became the band's signature. He was asked to leave when drug addiction and mental illness overshadowed his work. Pink Floyd paid tribute to Syd Barrett on the album Wish You Were Here with the song Shine On, You Crazy Diamond.
Remember when you were young? You shone like the sun.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
In your eyes, like black holes in the sky.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.